Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 423, January the 11th, 1980. I mentioned several weeks ago that the price of tapes the first of the year would go up to $4.30 instead of $4. And for people that live in California, that's 26 cents in addition, $4.56 for each tape. The tape center has increased costs as postage expenses and the increased rate of the tapes, and they haven't raised their prices for several years. So many of you order tapes in advance of prorate it or figure out that extra 30 cents per tape and then send it to the tape center or send it to me as you do your regular checks, and I'll pass it on to them in case you didn't make allowance for that 30 cents per tape. The return address on the cassettes going out now will no longer have the name of the Famous Voices Museum at Fisherman's Wharf here in Monterey. It will have my return address, and you have to send, if you have a problem with the tapes, send them back to me and I'll deliver them over there. They duplicate the tapes for me, but they no longer wish to have their name associated with the contents of the material that's included. That's their privilege. They don't have to. They have mentioned that I'm beginning to sound too un-American and that the content of the material is getting too militant, and they no longer want to be associated with the content. That's perfectly okay with me, and I understand that position. As far as my own political view, for some of you that just are beginning to take the tapes or have known me for a long time, I consider myself a severe critic of the United States of America. I see the faults of other countries too, but I live in this country, and I have to be busy clinging this up just as I would be a critic of my own home or my own surroundings, and it would be necessary to keep those in order. It doesn't matter how other people keep house or what they do. My own immediate country, family, person has to remain somewhat organized and clean and moral and very particular about the way this life is lived in order to make it the best possible, not only for me, for the people around me or my community. I'm tired of assassination teams that are sent all over the world from the United States. I don't like phony elections where we don't have a choice of a candidate and the candidates are killed off. I don't like poison in our food and air or corruption, exploitation of the native population here. The Indians, one-third of them are now sterilized, and many are getting uranium treatments and cancer from the Indian reservations leaking uranium and other problems that they're suffering with, and children removed to be educated in Mormon families. I'm against mind control and radio waves and leaking microwaves and ignorance and greed and stupidity around us and organized crime and drugs and narcotics, particularly as it pertains to the White House and the Justice Department and the high public officials. There's a lot of things I don't like, and I'll speak about them until I'm no longer here, until I die, and nobody has to be associated with this name. I'm proud of it, and I'll put on any envelope. It's me, Mae Brussel, and I hope it becomes a household word someday around this country. I've met a lot of interesting people through the research, and I have contact or been in contact with many people, researchers of my own peer group. This week, Ladislaus Farrago called me from back east. I believe he was in Boston, and he's coming to the West Coast and wanted to meet me. I have a list of his books, Aftermath, and several of the others on the various sheets that I've handed out. He was the gentleman from the OSS and CIA who first produced the story of the passports issued by Montini in the Vatican for Martin Bormann and Nazi spies. That was in Aftermath. Farrago has Game of the Foxes and another book, Destroy After Reading. I believe that's the name. I don't have that other book of his, but I have Game of the Foxes and Aftermath. And I told him I'd meet him at the Stanford Hoover Library. That is the repository of Hitler's papers and the Tsar's papers, and it's become a great library for studying revolution and counter-revolution. And I've never gone up to use that library for research, mostly because there's so much to do right here that it just doesn't make sense to go that far to travel. But he said he would give me a tour of the library and many parts of it, and if it's that available once I get into it, I may use it more often. But I was very happy to hear from him. He had a list of the tapes that have gone out. Somebody in Boston evidently gave him a list and gave him a couple of cassettes, and he had read my Realist article, the first published article I ever did, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? So when you speak to people like that or receive calls or letters from other writers or researchers, it is always not only reassuring, but it makes me know that I am on the right track and that these people are exposing for the same purpose, specifically because they are patriotic. That's why they're doing it. And they appreciate when somebody else is doing the same thing. Several weeks ago, I talked about Wilbur Evelyn, who's writing that book, The Rope of Sand, and the letter that he wrote to me and praised, you know, the work that I was doing. He was the bag man for Alan Dulles for a coup in Syria in 1956. So you see, we're miles apart, and yet this man is coming forward now and speaking from direct experience, and this research is very worthwhile to meet these people and understand what they were doing and why they were doing it, and understand why America now is being brought to its knees in a disgraceful position because of bad judgment, ignorance, false patriotism, and going after the wrong enemies at the wrong time. There was an editorial just last week in the New York Times called 31 Years of U.S. Glory and Illusion. It came out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen Miller from Harvard University, the Center for International Affairs, which is hardly a leftist, communist, or anti-American organization. This is very much the nest of the establishment group that Henry Kissinger came out. Mr. Miller talks about the decline of America and the false impression that America's had of their recent history, which really began a long time ago. And he briefly goes into the past 31 years of United States foreign policy. He says, during the late 1940s, the United States possessed a nuclear monopoly, yet in 1948, Czechoslovakia was submerged by the communists. In 1950, we had a stalemate in Korea, Nasser's triumph in Egypt in 1952, major crisis in Indochina and Taiwan in the 1950s, the Suez Crisis in 1956, the shock of Russia beating us with Sputnik in 1957, the toppling of pro-Western regimes in Cuba and Iraq in 1958, and Nikita Khrushchev's recurrent challenges in Berlin in the late 1950s. And he goes into the question of whether or not America's a second-class power. In 1958, Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson wrote a book, United States of America, Second-Class Power? In which they describe a deluge of defeats. This article goes on, such as Korea and so forth. And in the 60s, where we had American military superiority, we had a stalemate and lost in Vietnam. We withdrew from the Bay of Pigs after the French got out of the NATO military command. We were minus one of our strong allies. The Pueblo incident didn't come off as the intelligence wanted it. There was a revolution in Libya where pro-Western monarchy was thrown out. This is a list of setbacks, and he talks about the Soviet buildup in strategic forces and now Soviet posture in the Middle East moving in. But the question asked by Steve Miller from Center for International Affairs at Harvard, 31 years of U.S. glory and illusion. We've been prepped up and told that we were the best, the strongest, and if we don't really understand where we're going wrong or making mistakes, how can we possibly make it better? I would like to be writing a book on Lee Harvey Oswald, having done 16 years' work on the Kennedy assassination. And yet I found myself this week on Wednesday reading for 12 hours some of the most important articles of things are happening in various countries around the world. And it makes me think of the United States compared to, say, a piece of Steuben glass that we thought it was an artifact, something unique with all our freedoms and profit systems and advantages that other countries didn't have. We thought this was a choice piece of property and that we were chosen people in a way. And all of a sudden, when you drop that glass, that artifact, and it splatters into all of the little pieces that glass can have when it hits concrete or the bottom of that floor and breaks apart is about what the world is doing now. The United States and the world is simply rupturing in pieces. And so that instead of my being able to just quietly sit and write a book about a man named Lee Harvey Oswald and his 125 impersonations of people impersonating him, I spent hours and days looking at important stories, studying maps. There was an article in the New York Times, a map, December the 30th of this year. It's called Vital Statistics, and it has the names of a lot of deposed heads of states that were murdered in most of the countries where the Central Intelligence Agency had been behind these, the changes of government. Another article on the advantages and also the dangers of naval blockade in Iran and what it means to our oil and Japanese oil and Europe oil. Another day I spent studying the borders of the Soviet Union, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, the Arabian Sea, the Gulf of Oman, the Persian Gulf, studying these boundaries. What do they mean? How big are they? Where are the mountains? What is happening to these people on these land masses? Because it will affect us. Another good article this week on Tiny Oman guarding the Strait of Hormuz. Another one on Torrijos in Panama, that his power is eroding and the leftists and the people are about to rise up. He's another one that'll be gone soon. Of course, the candidate, I said, for deposed heads of states of dictators in 1980 is probably President Marcos in the Philippines. And this week's newspaper had an article, a very important step, in a major step to pacify opposition to martial law. Marcos offered freedom to a man that he's put in prison since 1972 and had a death sentence over him. He was a former senator, Mr. Aquino, who's 47 years old. He's given him a furlough from 7 years in jail and offered him a job on the Council of Leaders. That is very smart of Mr. Marcos, because sure as God made little apples, Marcos will fall pretty soon. But by having his opponent out of jail and given a position in government, he's going to delay that. The Soviets, there are articles out about why they went into Afghanistan, who Amin was, the man that was murdered, how he was funded by the CIA, how he was buying napalm, planning executions of his opponents. There were articles that he was described as a wild butcher, a usurper, a murderer of tens of thousands. The Soviets didn't go into Afghanistan to take the flak of the entire world unless they had a reason, and I was reading some of the background on Amin in AMIN in Afghanistan. Another interesting article about Syria. A representative in the United Nations from Syria is leaving Syria and going to Paris, and he's denouncing Assad's regime. He said it's repressive, it's a police state, and they're doing too much killing. Another article is about Pakistan, the murder of Bhutto, and in Bangladesh, a Rahman dead, and how they were replaced in these two countries by martial law and police states. And another one on why Pakistan may refuse U.S. arms. Another article this week on Mexico, the torture of 473 missing people, Indians, peasants, striking workers, and why the Shah was not won in Mexico, because his opulence and parties and caviars and minks and so forth called attention to the leftists that are ready to overthrow the president in Mexico. There's another interesting article in the New York Times on the torturing of the family of Kim Jae-kyu. He's been charged, along with the others, of killing the president of Korea, Mr. Park. But his family, his brother and sister-in-law and niece or nephew, child, went to Korea to see him after he was arrested, and they were forced to sign false statements that they took money out of Korea and that the money had been siphoned through them, and they were tortured. The child was watching the parents torture, the electrodes and beatings and clubbings, and kept in cells, torturing going on in Korea with this military government that's taken over. And of course, there are many good articles this past week on Saudi Arabia. Two of the heads of the Saudi Arabian government were removed at an airport, I understand, just a few weeks ago, and were beheaded. They have the commander for the armed forces was replaced. The commander of the border troops was replaced. The two army division commanders were replaced. Prince Fawaz, who resigned as mayor of Mecca, he was removed. He's a senior member of the royal family. He's the son of the late King Abdul, the founder of the kingdom there, and half-brother of the present king. If Saudi Arabia should turn anti-American either in a Muslim revolution or refuse to send United States oil, it would mean a total war in the Middle East for the United States to just grab and hold the oil, and we're planning to build bases there. The Saudi Arabian family has fights within it. It's very much insecure. It's shaking our gold market. They're buying our gold because they're ready to flee the country if they have to. So that all over the world, I'm just mentioning a few places, Mexico, Argentina, and Saudi Arabia, and these various countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the world is in turmoil. The United States has to send the Secretary of Defense over to China to get China to help arm, you know, eventually against Russia and help us in the Middle East. We're going to be caught in the middle of not knowing who our friends are, who our enemies are, sending weapons anywhere we can sell them, just as we sold the Japanese all the weapons and stockpiles that came back to us at the time of Pearl Harbor. The production of weapons and the selling of weapons seems to be the biggest industry going besides organized crime and oil. Those three have the monopoly for business, and the banking firms make money off of this war, loans to put up money and tremendous interest to carry on the warfare because the money really doesn't exist. So we're left right now in 1980, beginning a year with many countries in turmoil, many heads of states ready to roll, extreme poverty, and a waking of the third world. Again, I don't think it is anti-American to call attention to what is happening, because the only way you can deal with it is to understand it first. And understanding it takes lots of hours of reading, listening, buying books, reading newspapers, and so forth, and absorbing what it means to be in those countries, not what it means to be here, but to be in those countries, and watch what came down the last 30 years and see how they feel and how they're going to respond to what we our next moves. And you have to identify with what they're thinking, not what we're used to doing, but what we're capable of doing if we could identify with how they feel. Last week, I got off on a subject that I'm going to continue now, because international terrorism is the name of the game. Terrorism that is funded by the right, linked to the central intelligence agencies, a web or network that started after World War II, known as the Odessa or the Spider, that is the Nazi, neo-Nazi, right-wing clan, Minutemen, the Cagoulards, the Hooded Ones, a network of violence and bloodshed in order to gain control of the native population through terror or fear. These are universal Reichstags that are carried out with the assistance of organized crime, early Nazi money, and the help of the local police and the Justice Department in every country. I mentioned last week that George Corcalla, who has a corporation, Amstead Corporation in New Jersey, which trains and sets up assassination teams, and Frank Turpel of the CIA, were both arrested at the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C., and they did brag that they helped set up the Munich Olympic murders, where 11 Israeli athletes were killed. And I asked certain questions last week, which were answered in the news this week. One was, where do they get their weapons? Who's supplying them with the weapons and the assassination weapons and the assassination teams? And I also believe that this would connect up to Reverend Moon and the Korea Gate, which, in fact, it does this week. The answer to some of those weapons is that they're supplied by Mitchell Werbel. This Frank Turpel is described in the Washington Post this week, one of the men who was arrested, born in Brooklyn, enlisted in the Navy when he was 18. He was in the Navy, then went to the military, did a second tour of duty with the Armed Security Branch to repair cryptographic code-breaking equipment, and electronics training was extensive, according to the Army records. He left the Army in 1965 and joined the CIA as a communication specialist, so he must have worked for the National Security Agency with his cryptograph code breaking, and then left the CIA in 1971. He spent time in the Middle East and East Pakistan. He came to the attention in Washington in 1975, Turpel, because he was selling silenced MAC-10 and MAC-11 Ingram machine guns manufactured by Mitchell Werbel of Powder Springs, Georgia. MAC-11 machine guns weigh less than 4 pounds and so forth, and they've been featured in movies such as 3 Days of the Condor and The Killer Force. Remember, the Operation Condor is the assassination teams down in Chile of the Nazis that are sent all over the world. Now, this article in the Post said, Werbel, an internationally known arms dealer, said that from time to time Frank Turpel had worked for us selling our machine guns. But Werbel said that any dealings he had with Turpel were approved by the State Department Office of Munitions Control. An interesting thing is that this Mr. Mitchell Werbel, who's a czarist, a white Russian, and trained assassination teams all over the world, works very close with Lyndon LaRouche of the National Caucus of Labor Committee, and they trained his bodyguards and members of the committee go down and work with Werbel. Werbel is a rightist, a far right-wing reactionary, and LaRouche is closely associated with him. The New Solidarity of May 29, 1979, my birthday last year, has an article, How Zionists Control Arab Terror. But when you read the new articles coming out about the arrests in New York City of just two or three of the people involved in this worldwide organization, which has been identified by Scotland Yard as a safe house for organized crime, for people getting away, escapees, and for the Central Intelligence Agency combined, working with the highest echelons of government, these people are not the terror that they are spreading with their multi-million dollar, $10 million weapon sale a year is going to the right wing, not the left, and can be linked to international terrorism on the right. And, of course, LaRouche and Werbel fall right into that category, always blaming the Jews and always blaming the left. An interesting connection of Frank Turpel is his bragging and his claim that he trained this terrorist from Venezuela known as Carlos. Carlos is an important man that I said many times has also been a terror from the right disguised as a left. There's a book on Carlos that I may outline and put some of it on the tape if I get time by Colin Smith. And just the jacket describes Carlos. He killed two French policemen and an Arab informer in 1975. He shot Edward Seif, a British Zionist and chairman of Marks and Spencers, in 1973. In 1974, he organized the Japanese Red Army's assault on the French embassy in Holland. He launched a rocket attack at El Al Jet at Orly Airport in 1975, kidnapped 11 oil ministers at an OPEC meeting in 1975, was responsible for hijacking an Air France plane in Athens, and several of his gang were killed in Entebbe in July of 1976. Carlos has given security and housing for a getaway for Frank Turpel of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the list of his crimes is a mile long, and his connections and his weapons and his techniques are coming from what Werbel describes as permission from the State Department Office of Munitions Control. That's why the arrests in New York City were so important. The men, incidentally, were supposed to be on $1 million bail in separate jails. They've now been given $100,000 bail money, and they're out, and I'm sure that the $100,000 is the equivalent to a cufflink on each arm. There has been a total news blackout, with the exception of several articles in the New York papers and one in the Washington Post. There isn't a single article on the West Coast about the arrests of these men or their connections. Incidentally, the man who wrote the book on Carlos, The Portrait of a Terrorist, lived in Vietnam, Rhodesia, and the Middle East himself, and covered the revolution in Bangladesh. But in 1975, he was named the International Reporter of the Year for his series on Patty Hearst. And if I have time on this tape, I want to do some more on the kidnapping of Patty Hearst and the links of those people to South Korea, CIA, and the brainwashing of the Korean Operation Colston Westbrook and Wes Davis, working for Reverend Moon and the Central Intelligence Agency as part of an international group before Patty was kidnapped. So that the expert who won the International Reporter Year on Patty Hearst also wrote this book on Carlos. And when you see all the crimes that Carlos committed up to this day, and you realize that he was linked to this electronics firm in New Jersey, or to Frank Turpel of the Central Intelligence Agency, or to the Bobby Vesco, Billy Carter connections with Gaddafi in Libya, then you can draw a map or a net around the world and realize that a lot of the kidnappings, the hijacking, the murdering and bombing has been coming from the right, from these organizations, and they've been trying to blame the left. In the article in New Solidarity of the Labor Party that same May 29, 1979, they refer to a Mr. Jabara's activities that are being investigated by the Labor Party. This was last May, and his role in the defense team of Robert Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan. Well, the New Solidarity refers to it as the assassin. It was the alleged assassin, Thane Caesar, security guard from Lockheed, was the assassin of Robert Kennedy. And Sirhan was brought to Pasadena and his family in 1958 by the Greek Orthodox Church, the same CIA front that brought Marina Oswald to the United States in 1962. And Sirhan has already been offered protection by Gaddafi in the Middle East when he leaves, and he'll go to Libya and move there, the same country that is in cahoots, as I say, with Billy Carter and Robert Vesco and so forth. If they wanted to investigate the assassination of Sirhan, which is mentioned in the May 29, 1979 article, they would pursue it further and get on the heels of the Lockheed Thane Caesar murderer. But it's always this guilt by association and blaming the Zionists for the terror when it's coming from the most fanatical group on the right. There are so much in just the few articles that came out this past week on the arrests in New York City that I'm just going randomly to give you some of the most important information and can't begin to put it in lists or categories, but I'll share with you pieces of these particular characters that are being blocked out of most of the newspapers that you take around the country. You might call your editors or ask them, whether the Salinas Californian or whatever paper, why we aren't getting information on these arrests. Mr. Turple, described formerly of the CIA, works for a Washington-based company called Oceanic International. I might have mentioned that before. And Oceanic has offices both in Paris and in Panama. I thought, just as a coincidence, it was kind of interesting because in George Orwell's 1984, The Key to Oceania, that was the name of the control group that he described, that broke people into three social classes. And the key to the control of the population was the manipulation of language and speech and changing their words around. But the area that they described, that he describes in his book, is called Oceania. That's made up of the proles, the mindless workers that are 85% of the population, and the inner party, the elite, that's 2% of the population, and the remaining 13%, the outer party, which carries out the directives. Now, that's about the way this country breaks down now. It's 1980, but I think I mentioned once before the statistics of how many people actually make changes in our society one way or the other, but 85% are the compromising workers, and that's about the way Oceania or United States is right now. His offices are in Panama or Paris. Does Oceanic have links to Jonestown? There's millions of dollars down in banks in Panama and also Torrijos. And Turple links, his company links to organized crime and the safe house that Scotland Yard believed was for the CIA and organized crime. So I'm wondering the connections that, and London was very much a part of Jonestown. I might have brought that up last week, but what are the connections of Turple in Panama and in Paris and in London to the creation of this experimentation station down in Jonestown? The San Francisco Chronicle said that at the time of their arrest, in their possessions, they had 10,000 weapons, Ingrid machine guns, safe houses in London. They provided arms for the Palestine Liberation Organization, and they have cadres of men willing to go anywhere in the world to kill. This team have silencers. They have American-made ground-to-air red-eye missiles. They can blow up airplanes, such as that Chicago airplane, the DC-10, that simply exploded, that Sherman Skolnick said was blown up. This is an arsenal of weapons with an intent to make money and kill and control through assassination teams. If I did nothing else but talk about this network or this organization and its connecting links, we could do 52 weeks. This terror on the right is terribly important, as I have said before, because it looks like many Reichstags, as if the left is guilty, Yet it's funded by the federal government, and the justices protect these people, give them low bail so they can leave because they don't want trials. And the headlines are constantly of murder, and yet nobody is pinpointing how broad they are and how big the organization is and where it originally was funded and where it's going the next day, specifically tomorrow. On the other side of this tape, we'll do more about those arrests in New York and the importance of this organization and these men.